Hello, this is Kevin Doherty, your host for Just Thinking. I am the Chief Strategy Officer for 806 Technologies, and I have an incredible guest today, someone from down under. Brett Salakis is here with us today. I'm actually recording here in Texas. I think Brett's been to Texas before. I can't recall, but maybe he'll tell you a little bit about that. But Brett, for those who are listening and are watching who don't know who you are, although I don't imagine there are many since you are now the top 100 influencers, according to DA Magazine. So there's a lot of people who know Brett Salakis. But Brett, for those who may not know who are you, brother?
Oh, well, I mean, you're lucky the people who are listening on Spotify won't be able to see this, but the people who are watching the video will obviously be able to see how gorgeously beautiful and handsome I am. But former male model, but not at all, just quietly, just not at all. But you can probably tell from the accent, obviously from Australia. Look, I'm a primary school teacher. Once upon a time, a little while ago, when Twitter was called Twitter and before it was called X, I started a little group called Aussie Ed, which accidentally grew to be the largest online network of teachers in Australia. Oh. And from that and those connections that I had from there, certainly, as you know, networking and talking and communicating and sharing ideas and learning got me thinking, and I've been able to pen a few books that have done particularly well. And you know what? Just from there, I have learned that I wrote a post the other day that just like a boomerang, this is going to be a nice little Australia thing. Just like a boomerang, the more love you can throw out into the world, the more love will come back to you in return. So that's true for life. That's true for education. That's true for learning. So the more I can put out and share and connect and throw out there into the beautiful world that we all exist in, the more I can get back tenfold. And that's how I try and live my life, like a big old love boomerang.
I love that. Hey, so you mentioned penning some books. You've got a fairly recent book, right?
Well, I do have. So I've got a mammoth lesson, Teaching in the Digital Age. It's probably my really big one that did particularly well over in the US. That was very nice. And I guess on the back of that, I get to get invited over for a few conferences here and there over in the States. But it did quite well in Canada and actually New Zealand and particularly well down here in Australia. Although I actually have a new one about to come out that I hadn't even actually told you about. I've got a new one coming out in about, let's say, 2 months. My editor just sent me all my edits. I've got to do a big edit thing in about 2 or 3 weeks' time. And so hopefully it'll be out very soon. But it's an interesting one. We know that AI is on the tip of everyone's tongue at the moment. And I had an incident, and I might even share what that incident was because it sparked the name of the book and the whole concept of this book. Mm-hmm. But I've written a eulogy for the essay. And that's the title of the book. And you know, Age of AI. A eulogy for the essay, Authentic Assessment in the Age of AI. And the reason that came about is towards the ending of the academic year last year, a very, let's say, a high fee private school, very, very high fee private school here in Australia approached me, because I do a lot of work with different education systems across Australia and a lot of policy and a lot of leadership sort of stuff at a pretty high tier. And it was actually a guy I had taught with years and years ago when I was just a humble old teacher. And he came up to me and he said, I need you to come out. I need some advice. We've had some students that we suspect have been using ChatGPT to write their essays. And this particular assessment task was a weighted assessment task that goes to their final leaving mark at the ending of year 12. So it would be weighted into what we call our ATAR, which is our university entrance rank sort of program. So if they were to have used, obviously, AI to generate essays that would be weighted and assessed and then influence their university entrance, a bit of an issue.
Yes.
And so I'm having a yarn with him, and he wanted to know you know, he's using AI detection software. He goes, what are other schools? What's the magic number of percentage of AI detection that schools are comfortable with or uncomfortable with? And I said, right, like I'm listening. I said, look, before we talk too much about that, number one, none of the AI detection stuff is worth a pinch of salt. Like it's rapidly changing. Every week, the AI detection quality or accuracy is decreasing. So you can't value that at the moment. I'm sure someone will build a better mousetrap at some point, right? Every time there's a better mouse, someone builds a better mousetrap. But but explain to me the task. And effectively, it was a take-home essay. It was an essay that you would take home, write the essay, kids would work on it, bring it back, teacher would mark it. And I said, you don't have an AI policy issue. You have an assessment policy issue. That's the age of a take-home essay is gone. That's dead. That is dead. You cannot do that. And from that, saying that the take-home essay is dead, that is no longer a valid assessment tool. Hence, then thinking about the death of the essay and the need to have a eulogy for the essay. What have we learned from it? How will the essay live on in all of us and metaphorically? And what does that all mean? So, that all sort of flowed together.
That's awesome. That's going to be great.
I hope so. So, yeah, couple of months' time.
So, you serve as an education ambassador. What does that mean?
Yeah, so it's a little bit different to probably in North America. When you guys hear of ambassadors, when you hear the term ambassador, you tend to probably think of it as quite often in the States, it's the ambassador is like someone who's like a little champion for a product or a tool or something like that. Right. So down here, the ambassador concept or word is a little bit more like the traditional understanding of ambassador, like in a diplomatic sort of sense. So I have literally the absolute coolest job in the world. I work for an American company. I work for HP, which many of you would know as Hewlett Packard, which is big in trouble at work. If you say the word Hewlett Packard, you've got to say HP. So I work for HP, and I'm actually supported by and sort of powered by Intel. Intel actually look after me particularly well. Nice. But effectively, I'm the education ambassador for Australia and New Zealand. And my role is very, very simple, is I am to champion and advocate for good digital practice whenever and wherever I can. So sometimes that can mean supporting a little school in the middle of nowhere and giving them a little bit of extra love and helping some of their teachers at a small scale. And sometimes it can mean sitting down with a district or a department of education for one of our states and actually guiding and shaping and leading their policy review. And those two things are two things that I'm doing literally at the moment. I'm shaping the and writing the policy of a department of education over here that I'm not allowed to mention the name of that for NDA reasons.
Yes.
But at the same time, I'm, you know, flying in 2 weeks' time out to a little Indigenous community, an Aboriginal First Nations community, working with a little school about 8 hours north of Perth in the middle of the desert, and working with some teachers there and some kids there to upskill their digital sort of sense and doing some video, teaching them video editing and things like that. So both extremes. I have spent the last 10 to 15 years of my life. In every spare moment, I was in a traditional leadership role within a school.
Yes.
And I would pour my passion on after hours and on weekends about education technology and advocating for that and doing that work with Aussie Ed that I mentioned and all that sort of stuff. And then along came someone who said, we would like you to do that, but we'll pay you to do that. So now my passion is my full-time gig. And I get to basically just go around Australia and New Zealand and quite regularly different parts of the world and, advocate for good digital teaching practice.
Well, you know, you have the advantage of getting to see a lot of different things, a lot of different environments and so forth. you get to see some of the similarities, because I'm sure there are common issues, common challenges across the board. And then there are some things that are unique. And so, you know, it's an advantage position, because the people in the system or in the school sometimes have great difficulty seeing the forest through the trees. So you're able to facilitate the seeing of the forest through the trees, but you're also able to bring context from a variety of different environments and take some of what you learned over here and bring it and help them over here. And so speak to me a little bit more about that experience for you, that kind of, I don't know, the little bit of comparing and contrasting that's going on and the seeing the forest through the trees. Am I anywhere close
What did you do? Yeah, spot on. Look, I think even before we hit record and started this, we had a little bit of a preamble conversation, and I think about three quarters of what we spoke about probably could have been a podcast in itself. You should have hit record there. We should have had the pre-podcast episode. We'll do the podcast and then hit record a third time, and we'll do the debrief. But it's funny. I know you spent some time in the UK in your younger teaching days. So even myself, I started teaching in Sydney, and then I spent a little bit of time in Indonesia. And actually, my first taste of leading a school was in Singapore. I lived in Singapore for an extended period of time. So nice. I had a real East meets West teaching experience that really, really shaped the way that I view education as an educator myself. I have that mm-hmm. I've got that creative spark and that let's think outside the box and let's make, you know, 21st century learners, all that sort of stuff. I've got that very Western concept. Yes. But at the same time, that Singaporean drill and explicit and knowledge and depth of detail that is pride of place within the Singaporean education system. And so that was in my early, sort of days of teaching. So I do have personally that real East meets West, and it's quite funny. I see, you know, there's a constant argument at the moment of extreme views. You know politically you've got left and right, and there's great extreme poles of what people think. But in education, there's your digital advocates and your let's return to the basics, the 3 R's, all that sort of stuff. But I see a lot that argument between explicit teaching and inquiry and open and people argue so much at the ends of these extremes. And I'll tell you now, I think that's junk. I think that's a junk false argument. I think that's a rubbish false argument. I think even as much as politically, when we look at extremists from left and right, we go, the tiniest percentage of people actually think at those extremes. But that's the noise that we all hear. Most of us live somewhat in the middle, and we can see parts of arguments from either side, and we exist in the middle. But the noise that gets echoed is these two extremes, because they're the sound bites and they're the noise. Mm-hmm. I think we fall into the same trap in education, that we hear this. We hear the extreme, extreme explicit and the extreme, extreme open and inquiry. The reality is they exist, they coexist together in the middle. And our practice is best when we have elements of both of those, because we do want that East meets West concept. We do want deep knowledge and understanding, and we need to be able to spell, and we need to know our punctuation, and we need to know our mathematical facts, and we need a core explicit knowledge base. But we also need to be creative and utilize that knowledge in clever and innovative ways, because that's exactly why we have an education system, to prepare our students to be able to enter as functioning, effective adults into their work life. So I think there is parity there. So when you say like what's similar, what's different, I think sometimes the nuance of the argument might be different.
Yes.
The topic might be different from country to country. But the concept and the experience is actually very, very similar. Mm. We often have politicians pulling in one way, parents pulling in another, and teachers trying to find that balance and engage students and work to a curriculum and do it. Now, pick your country, there might be a different political push at any particular time, you know, depending on who the elected government is. But that same concept of there is a political element to a curriculum, there's a parent base that is sometimes progressive and sometimes conservative. And in the middle of that, you've got these teachers who are just trying to engage kids and make them love learning and teach them the best they can. I think that's a universal experience.
Well, and as you're talking about that, you've taken me all the way back to when I was a classroom teacher. And I started actually at a primary school in London in the British system. And then I moved to Texas for a little while, which was like another country coming from New England. And then I taught for several years in my hometown of Bedford, Massachusetts, outside of Boston. And I had some wonderful diversity in my classroom. Is a fairly high-tech area there off 128 in Boston. So there were a lot of people from different parts of the world. And I had a student from South Korea. And I was one of those very creative outside-the-box teachers. Kids had hamsters in their pocket. We had goldfish. We had a stage in the classroom. And we did nature walk. We did all kinds of crazy stuff. But what was interesting is the mom said, "I love this for my daughter. But I'm from South Korea. And I would love to see a perfect blend between the education that I had, which was very rigid, very specific in the way, you know, we had to learn, and this very creative, open way in which you're teaching in your classroom." And I love it very much, but I really think the best would be to blend the best of both of those together. And that's kind of what I'm thinking about as you're sharing.
I concur with what you said. I've always argued it. I've always described it as an East meets West type of concept. I think that would be a wise thing. I might. Have you ever heard of the phenomena called the wild geese of Korea?
No, I have not.
So there's migratory birds that what these wild geese, funnily enough. And they will they'll be born in Korea, they will leave for years and years and years, and then they will eventually migrate back and have their children and all that sort of stuff. There's an educational phenomena in Korea, and you know, when we're talking to I'm sure a lot of your listeners would be familiar with PISA and, you know, international rankings and all that sort of stuff. And quite often, you know, when a politician wants to leverage his own point, he'll you have, I'm sure, the same experience as us, as, "Oh, we used to be ranked blah blah blah, and now we're fallen, and we're now this rank and all that sort of stuff." And we all know everyone can manipulate statistics to get any point that they want across, right? But These PISA tables, these global sort of ranking tables, usually have a lot of Asian countries scored very, very high. I lived and taught in Singapore, and Singapore often is number one there. But the brutality of the assessment regime in Singapore from kindergarten onwards is brutal. We wouldn't be comfortable with that in a Western country. And a surprise, surprise, when you have brutal assessments that from age of five are really, really significant to a child's overall academic success, the kids there get really, really good at taking tests really, really young. So when you do it at 15 for PISA, they're really, really good at taking tests. Does it mean their education system's better? I don't know, but it certainly means they're darn good at taking tests.
Yes.
But this concept of the wild geese of Korea. Korea also scores very highly in all these PISA ranking tables. However, at any one time, there is over 500,000 students, and they split often families up. Usually, dad will stay and work. Mum will migrate to a Western country and take the children with them and give the child a Western experience of education so that they will learn and think and understand from an American education system, from an Australian, from a British. They want that Western thinking built into their children, because they know when they migrate back, when the geese fly home several years later, they've had that foundation of Korean, that rigid, explicit Korean traditional instruction, but the mind opening opportunities that come yes. with a Western mindset of education. And I, so they return there with all this advantage over their peers who stayed. So it's an interesting concept, this wild yes. geese of Korea from an educational perspective. And often when I hear politicians talking about these falling you know, ranks and all that sort of stuff, and are they falling, or are other countries that were once third world countries raising up to meet us? Because we want the right. world to be a better educated place. Like, you can't empower everyone and still say, I want to be better than you all. Like, that's not right. that's not how things work. Like, I can't right. be the world champion boxer, teach everyone else how to box as well as me, but go, yeah, but I still want to be better than you all. I still want to dominate you all. That's right. not how it works.
Right.
What is it that these hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Koreans every single year see in a Western education that statistically in these PISA ranking tables are ranked much lower? What is it that they're seeing that our politicians can't see, that they can value and understand?
Yes.
That unarticulated magic of an American education system, Australian education system, a New Zealand learning experience.
Yes.
What is that? And I think that's worth discussing. Yes. And I think that's worth then embracing, because if we can understand that and we can know that, we can push that forward and enhance that.
You know, I'm sure you've read or seen speak Young Sao. Have you seen Young yeah. Sao speak? Yeah.
Yes.
So it was probably a decade ago I heard him speak to this, because he said, you know, I know Americans are bemoaning the fact that they've fallen off and they're at this level in the ranking and so forth. He said, where do you think the people of China want to send their kids to college, university? Often it's US or maybe some yeah, of these of other course. Countries that you just mentioned that are, you know, had been to the top, near the top.
You can say the word Australian. I know that Americans are very patriotic, but you can say the word Australia. It's all right, my friends. Don't tell the rest of the world, and don't tell New Zealand. They're our next door neighbor. Don't tell New Zealand. But you know what? But, Aussies and Americans, we're good mates. It's all it's yes, okay.
Well, especially Texan Americans.
Oh, don't get me started on Buckies. I love Texas. You got to.
We don't want to alienate.
I went to the Alamo once, and this is true story, 100% true story. I went to the Alamo. I was in Austin, and I drove up to San Antonio. Thank you. Yeah. Drove up to San Antonio. Had my first ever Buc-ee's experience on that journey. I fell in love with Buc-ee's that day. We were talking beforehand. I need to, if I come over for a conference for you, I expect to be paid in Buc-ee's beaver nuggets. I'm addicted to them. But but I was in the Alamo.
Yes.
And you see you know, all the cliche characters that we all know. And in the gift shop, without a word of a lie, was a boomerang for sale.
Get it.
Because we all know Davy yes. Crockett had his trusty boomerang. and Jim Bowie, Davy Crockett, they all carried boomerangs at that. Remember the Alamo. Santa Ana never had those boomerangs by his side. That was part of the heroic struggle. But I just thought it was hilarious, and I found this boomerang for sale in the Alamo gift shop.
That is awesome. Hey, so as you're talking about, you know, being around and the political polls and some of the extremes and what gets the sound bites and that sort of thing, these have been interesting times for education. I'm yeah. sure it's not much different in Australia as it is in the yeah. U.S. and so forth, teacher shortages and difficult keeping people in those leadership roles and so forth.
Yeah.
So, but what I want to hear from you, because you do travel around a lot, you talk to a lot of people, what are the things that you're seeing out there that are the most encouraging right now? The silver linings, the positive things that are happening that don't get a lot of press.
Yeah. Well, even, do you know what, there's one particular thing that I actually really strongly believe. And I'm going to say about AI. I'm going to talk about AI. And I know ad nauseum, every man and his dog's talking about AI. Oh, there's a nice little Australian expression for you right there. Every man and his dog. Everyone's talking about AI right now. But I want to talk, I wouldn't mind saying two things about it.
Okay.
But the real positive thing I would like to say about it first, let's do the positives first, right?
Okay.
The real positive thing about it, and we're seeing the early stages of this with Sal Khan and Khan Migo and all this sort of stuff, this ability to individualize student feedback in real time. We know that differentiation is very, very difficult. That's the great challenge of education, right? How do I push my high achievers? How do I nurture my struggling students? And how do I manage the needs of the core all at the same time? That's a tough ask.
Yeah.
So, you know, for those who haven't come across Khan Migo, it's effectively like an individualized tutor where if I can set some, I'm doing linear equations with my students, I'm teaching linear equations to a grade 9. And I've got, you know, I've got Kevin over in the corner who's an absolute whiz. You know, he needs extra support to push him, but I've got poor old Brady Salarkis in the corner there, you know, struggling, doesn't even know how to rub two sticks together. Like he needs particular attention, right? And you got everyone in the middle. Being able to set linear equations and have individualized real-time feedback and instructions. Have you thought about this? Have you tried this? What is this? What's this mean? That's magical.
Yeah.
And the power of that individualized feedback, real-time feedback. We know, Hattie's research shows that one of the greatest effect sizes is feedback. And if we can give real-time personalized feedback, then that's one of the greatest benefits of AI. But that's not my point about AI, because that's good and we know this, right? Like we people can get that. But what people don't talk about is I'm pretty sure that no 15-year-old I know is going to do linear equations because the bloody computer screen says do linear equations. They do linear equations because Miss has asked them and they respect Miss, or Sir at the front of the classroom has sat with them and explained it and they've got a bond, a connection. So with all of this growth in AI individualized feedback and tutoring, and the fear that like how much of a teacher role will AI take? The reality is, the beauty of a challenging teenager and a young child is that we need the human connection,
right?
And AI is not ever going to be able to provide that human connection. So I think AI eventually, as we work out pedagogically how we want to use it.
Mm-hmm.
I think AI surprisingly has, and I'm saying this just so I can feel the sun rise behind me. I know the sun's setting where you are. I can feel the sun just coming because I can feel the momentum going. I think AI has the potential to actually increase the humanity within our classroom, because whilst AI is now doing the grunt work for us, the bits and pieces that took our time as educator, the kid only does the work. The students aren't going to do the work because of the relationship they have with the teacher. So now with AI doing the grunt work, we can actually spend more time. We are freer to spend more time to bond with the children in our care, to actually connect, to know them, to connect with them so that they know us, and to really, you know, I can feel that sun rising. I don't know if they're almost like this is a spiritual moment. I don't know if it's coming across in the video.
Go into a crescendo. Go.
But no, that point that AI has the potential to enhance the humanity that is experienced within our classrooms. That's actually what I believe is truly going to be possible and truly going to be AI's legacy within education. But we've got to do it right.
Yes. Yes.
We've got to do it right. And we can't let the politicians, if we allow our role as educators to be seen as content delivery mechanisms, and quite often that's how someone who pays the bills, like a politician who pays the cost and the bill of politicians endorse a curriculum,
Yes.
And we are employed to deliver that curriculum. That's how sometimes we're seen as our wage, right? But if we allow ourselves, we allow our industry, we allow our vocation to be seen and understood as curriculum delivery mechanisms, then we put ourselves at risk of AI replacing us, because AI can do that stuff 10 times faster, 100 times faster than we can. What it can't do is lean into the humanity and bond with the child. So I think, funnily enough, if we need to champion that relational aspect of our learning experience now, and maybe go back to the old ways, embrace the old of what education once was, when it was like a mentorship and it was truly a bond between student and tutor. And you nurture that child and through their development and raise them up to meet their potential. And there's real care, that care between that relational bond. That's what excites me. And I don't think enough people are talking about that just now.
I really appreciate that thought around that. And it makes me think about a conversation I had recently with Dr. Ray McNulty. You and I were talking about him before we started the podcast officially, but he was saying, in terms of mixing things up, and this, he first threw it out there about 5 years ago, but he said, nothing wrong with the title, the name teacher. I mean, it's been around forever and it's a great word and name. But his fear was that there was a devaluing of the teacher and the role of teacher along the lines of what you were just describing. So what he pitched was, hey, Kev, what if we called a teacher a learning engineer? Because in essence, what a teacher is doing, if they're doing their job right, is they're effectively engineering the learner of every learner that she or he serves. And when you think about the esteem level that teachers enjoy or don't enjoy in various parts of the world or even various parts of a nation or region, if we elevated their position, even just through their title, what we call them, because when you look at all the things that a teacher does on a daily basis that are so often dismissed. We don't even pay much attention. We look at the test scores. We look at the bottom line. What? And not that that's unimportant, but all those things that you just were alluding to, the relational things, the mentoring things that are going on that are part of that engineering component. And so I just was thinking that, you know, a learning engineer is charged with the role of effectively engineering the learning of every learner that they serve so that they can be, you know, better engaged, equipped, and empowered. Because ultimately, you want the learner to own that understanding, that skill, that knowledge, that ability to question and problem solve and move toward that empowerment versus, you know, an enablement, which is kind of a little bit of that piece we were just talking about, this more rigid, you know, get your facts and so forth, which is, you know, it's great, but if I don't know how to apply that and I can't use that in some creative way, then, you know, then it doesn't empower me in the way that education should. All right. I'm tired of hearing my own voice, Brett. I want to hear your reactions, responses. What are you thinking?
Well, actually grateful for you talking there, because it is, 6-ish a.m. I think it's getting close to 7 now as that sun's rising. But I just had to have a little cough of when I'm mute and have a little cough while you were there. clear my morning throat a little bit. Look, I concur with everything you said. Like I think you and I are on the I think you were definitely on the same wavelength with that. That's not to say though that there aren't certain risks as we move forward as well. And I do think a reimagining or a re-understanding, that there's a pivotal time of change, and I think you're in Texas, right? Like one of the famous I guess parallels with this AI revolution was the calculator revolution, and it doesn't, for those people who are listening in, you may not know, when Texas was the first jurisdiction in the world to start bringing calculators into mathematics classrooms. Good old Texas Instruments.
Right down the street.
Yeah, there you go. But, you know, the Mathematics Teachers Association went on strike. You can Google right now. Go, your listeners, go and Google the calculator strikes across Texas. Teachers were not happy. People feared what was going to happen to learning, what was going to happen to their job. How would they teach? How is mathematics even going to exist? Like, calculators going to stop children being able to learn mathematics and all this sort of stuff. And what we know is obviously there was a concern, a worry, and a truth to what they were saying too, because the learning that was existing, the processes that were existing, were lost and gone. I don't know how to use logarithmic tables. Do I need to know how to do logarithmic tables? Probably not. I can use the little logarithmic button on my calculator if ever I so desire, which I haven't really desired since I left school. But in the same way, there was a period of disruption, particularly obviously in the mathematics world. How do we change teaching? How do we adjust teaching with this new tool called a calculator? Upheaval, discomfort, but it took a few years. We've got that same discomfort now. How do we teach? How does the role of teacher? This was obviously, the calculator was very specific in mathematics. AI is changing a lot of all of our roles. So we're all experiencing that discomfort. Pardon me. So what does that mean? So I think there's going to have to be a period of discomfort, a period of exploration, whilst we figure this stuff out. And I hope what we get to, and then this is why we need to empower as many teacher voices as possible, not industry voices, teacher voices, because we need to get to a point where we don't have the Sam Altmans of OpenAI leading the conversation about education and AI. We have the teachers, the leaders, the superintendents, the people who have a career and an understanding of the nuance of learning, leading the conversation about how AI plugs into us, not how we plug into it. And I think that's very, very important. Which probably leads me to what I'm going to be very Australian and be very blunt. I've got a bit of a bee in my bonnet of AI grifters. And I really, really specifically call, there's a lot of people who I reckon are AI grifters. And you know, I've got a good friendship with a brother of mine who actually is in Austin down the road, or a little bit west of you.
I know who you're talking about, yes.
Good old Carl Hooker. And Carl loves...
Let's mention names while we're at it.
No. Good old Carl Hooker loves that. I love Carl. Carl loves it. I use the phrase AI grifters, because I think there are a lot of people who are positioning themselves as experts in AI education, and influencing policy and influencing direction. And the reality is, I don't think there is such a concept as AI education expert, because you can be an education expert, no doubt, and you can be an AI expert 100%. There are people who are geniuses at that. There are very, 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 very few people in the entire world who have spent enough time merging the concepts of AI and education together to see longitudinal impacts on different pedagogical practice on student learning. It doesn't exist. So anyone who has on their LinkedIn profile AI education expert, I've got question marks. I'm telling you now. Use the word AI grifters. Call them out, because I have a concern that people have instincts and thoughts, and I'm not saying all these people are bad people, but they're passionate people. It's good to be passionate, right?
Sure.
But right now, we're all exploring. Like as I said, we're in this phase of change. We are exploring options, and we're doing our best guesses, and we are trained professionals, and we're doing what we think and we have learned, and experience tells us this would be a good practice. But we're not experts in that practice. We're exploring AI in education. And I think that's important to distinguish between an exploration and an expertise. because otherwise you can influence direction and have unexpected consequences. I'm a primary school teacher originally by trade, and one of what got me on to using this term AI grifter originally was learning that since ChatGPT has become a thing, children's books on Amazon, the volume of children's books on Amazon has increased over 9,000-fold. Over 9,000 percentage increase in the amount of titles in children's books. Now, that concerns me for a reason. And a lot of people, you know, there are advocates, and there is an argument, and I'll give credit where credit's due. There is an argument for AI can and enhance and allow people who can't express ideas to be able to express ideas that they couldn't before. All valid things, all in its right context. I agree with all of that. But as a species, the human species, as a species, for survival needs, as a child, we need to be particularly egocentric. A child has to cry for its mother's milk for survival. A child has to cry when it's too cold so it doesn't die of exposure.
Right.
A child has to cry for food when it's hungry so that it gets nourished. Developmentally, we need to, when we're young, we need to focus in on self for survival. That's how the human species works, right? Mm-hmm. We all know this. So when do we first start having empathy? We first start having empathy when we don't think about ourselves, when we start being able to think of other people. In a Western culture, in a Western society, mostly, most often, that's done through stories. Like when we first hear the Lorax, we learn, you know, we learn the Lorax advocating for the trees, because the trees can't speak for themselves. And the needs, I think it's called, the needs. But as a Western culture, we experience empathy for the first time through children's books, through picture books. That's our first exposure to being able to see things from other perspectives and have empathy for someone else. Now, if there's a 9,000% increase in children's books, clearly that's being written by AI, a tool that in its nature has no empathy. It can mimic the storyline of what a and play pretend of a storyline of what a children's book may look like. It'll have grammatical structures of a beginning, a middle, an end, and all that sort of stuff. But the moral, the lesson, the understanding that we get from books is a special bond between author and reader. And when a reader experiences something, there's a magical spark of understanding, of conveying of humanity and its message in that moment.
Yes.
And I'm very concerned that if we have outsourced the development of children's literature to AI, we have an influx of stories that have no empathy, that mimic a children's story, that lack actual empathy. If we rob, if these AI grifters, and I'm actually very fired up, if these AI grifters rob a generation of the introduction of empathy to our species, what are we stealing from our children? And that's why I like using the term AI grifters, because I want it to resonate. I want it to jar with people, because I want people to say, maybe there is a use case for AI in the right times. Of course there is. 100% there is.
Yeah. But
maybe we need to be smart about it. Go back 15 years. If we had the chance to put some guardrails around social media to help with the well-being and empathy of our youth, if we knew what was social media was going to evolve into and how that the dynamic of that on our youth, would we put different legislative powers to protect and nurture our
Yes.
young ones? Of course we would.
Right.
We should learn from that, and we should, and this children's, this explosion in children's books, I think, is a early litmus test of some of the things that we need to be cautious of, because being a blind advocate for AI, being a grifter that just wants to be the cutting edge person talking lean policy, can have unintended impact. Because again, none of us are experts in AI in education. We are all exploring it, and we need to be careful and cautious and aware of that.
So
that's my two cents, brother.
Hey, this is just thinking. So I love hearing your thinking about this and what you back up your thinking with, Brett. I have a colleague, Cindy Gibson, I work with at 806 Technologies, and she was saying that her children that are in their early 20s, early mid-20s, say that they can sniff out the use of AI and things that are written, that they have another sense about it because of certain patterns. And it's funny, I'm still relatively new with the use of it, but I've started to see certain patterns that, you know, because I'm a pattern seeker all the time. I'm looking for those patterns. And, but would I be an expert and be able to tell whether something? Probably not. But I am starting to see some of these things. And these young people that are exposed to it on a more constant, frequent basis, maybe they do start to see some patterns and that kind of thing. But you reminded me of a story that has to do with empathy, because you touched on something really important to my heart as an educator, someone who's been an educator, served educators for 40 years. And that is the focus on the things that we have in common, the things that connect us together, our humanity that you discussed. I was an assistant principal, did all the discipline. I told you about my school in Houston, tremendously diverse, kids from lots of different backgrounds, and they get in fights, as kids would do. They come into the office and they were just like, I don't like him, I can't stand her. I say, go in that room. I want you to write 10 things you have in common. So they go in the room, they sit there for a while. I don't know, we have nothing in common. 10 things that you have in common. So they knock on my door. We have 3, is that enough? Nope. Got to come up with 10. And I go back to come up with 10. And I did this tens of times, maybe hundreds of times. Kids would come back arm in arm, laughing, best mates. And I never had a recurrence because they took the time to focus on the things that connected them and the things that could bond them together on their shared humanity. And a simple thing like just sitting down and being forced to identify those 10 things you have in common had an almost magical impact on the relationship and the interaction of those two individuals from that point forward. So when you talk about empathy, that is something that resonates with me, the importance of fostering, developing empathy as educators and the learners that we serve. So I so appreciate you you hitting on that with this point as well.
Yeah, no, you would love. I wish I could somehow wrangle. I'm actually doing a keynote in Auckland, New Zealand, next week, next Tuesday.
And you're inviting me to come?
Yeah, come over, brother. Come over.
Okay, sure.
But the title of the keynote is enhancing humanity using AI, and I'm going to walk through a few practical ways to literally do that. So. Make no mistake, I'm an advocate for AI. I actually am an advocate for it. Like I use it every day of my life. I think it has a very growing importance within education space. But we need to do that wisely and cautiously and informed and carefully and not blindly. And I think there's a subtle nuance of difference with that advocacy. But I might even just, I hadn't actually talked about this in such a long time. I know we've used the term expert a little bit, and yes. I'll get away from grifter. I do like grifter. Shout out to Carl. When you promote this, tag Carl in the promotion. Yeah. Say, hey, the AI grifter phrase it gets bandied about. But The concept of expert, what does it take to be an expert? And this is not necessarily exactly what we've been talking about, but have you ever heard of a concept or an initiative called the DAN plan?
The Dan,
DAN,
DAN.
yeah, that might be an accent thing.
Yeah.
I'll try and clean the accent up. The
Yeah.
DAN, DAN, the DAN plan. Have you come across that?
I have
So
not.
Google, everyone, all your listeners, have a quick Google of the DAN plan. And effectively, there's a concept around in academic circles that it takes about 10,000 hours to be an expert at something. You need to devote 10,000 hours to something. And if you do that for 10,000 hours, you're pretty darn good at it by the ending
Yes.
of it. You would be an expert at that. And, obviously teachers, 10,000 hours adds up to, depending on how many hours a week you're doing it. It's a fair few years of of focus. So it probably is why when you enter the teaching profession, about year 7 or year 8 of your teaching, you suddenly things come a little bit easier. You can somehow manage to control the class, get the work done, meet all your curriculum needs, just with the raise of the eyebrow, have children quaking in their boots, all those things that as a young teacher, like how do you even control? I can't even get them to sit still, and the experienced teacher just with the glance can manage like 150 students. That you're a deputy. How many kids did you have at your school when you were a deputy?
700 kids.
700 kids. You wouldn't even need to utter a word. Just the look to bring silence over 700. That comes with experience, expertise. But the DAN plan is this dude who decided to put this concept of 10,000 hours of training and preparation to test, and he decided he wanted to learn golf. And if he did 10,000 hours of training and document that with blogs and videos and all that sort of stuff, he wanted to see how could he do 10,000 hours of focus on golf to go from a non-golfer to a professional elite player earning his living playing golf. Now, unfortunately, I think lots of COVID and stuff got in the way of the full complete narrative. I think he gets up to about 7,000 something hours, but he ends up getting on that I think the tech second or third semi-professional tier of the golf circuit, trying to make it in. And he goes, so I think that awareness and that knowledge that it takes time to become an expert. It takes focus and it takes purpose. And if you focus for long enough and you train for long enough and you purposefully do things with the intent to improve, not just do the same lesson or the same thing 1,000 times, the same 1 hour period, do that 1,000 times and replicate that, you're not growing there, but 1,000 hours of improving that 1 hour of teaching lesson. There's a difference between the two, but I just struck me when we're talking about the expert. I haven't talked about the DAN plan in quite a while. It's worth a little rabbit hole to go down to for any of your listeners just to explore that, because it's an interesting concept of developing an expertise within a topic.
Now, is that work just something that Malcolm McDowell references in his work as well? Have I thought I heard him
It
do some
might
of the
do.
similar
It
research.
might do. It Just remember, it is pretty early in the morning here.
That's
I'm
okay.
not. I'm
Well,
maybe not as
yep.
well. I have been drinking a big giant M monster drink to try and give me enough energy to wake me up to make sure I'm fully articulate for you. I didn't want that slow morning speech where already I know the accent can sometimes be a challenge for various listeners.
No.
But we all know how worldly Americans are famous for being worldly
Oh,
and able to understand accents from
yes,
all over
of
the planet.
course.
Well, they're
Yes.
famous for how
All right, could you?
inclusive they are.
I'll let you get your tongue out of your cheek, and we'll kind of wrap this thing up for today. But Brett, what I know is this is the first of many visits that we'll have here on Just Thinking. But I always like to close with, is there anything else at this time about which you're just thinking that I didn't give you a chance to address? And I'm going to give you the last word of sorts here to share that with everybody.
Yeah, do you know what? I'm not going to hammer anything I hadn't said. I think that the two things I want to finish with will be two of the things that I mentioned throughout. One I mentioned right at the beginning. One I mentioned right at the ending. So, at the beginning, in the middle, we talked a lot about humanity and the importance that humanity and relationship plays in education. And at the very start, I used that boomerang metaphor about pouring out love. And I think if we merge those two concepts to wrap up, why don't we focus on pouring out, be that boomerang, be that boomerang of love, be that boomerang of humanity, pour out love to all the relationships that you have, professional relationships, relationships with your students, relationships with your loved ones. Pour that out and just watch all that love and kindness come boomeranging right back at you. And if anyone there wants to boomerang all the way from the States over to Australia, boomerang some love here, and I'll throw it right back at you, brothers and sisters. Let's just make sure we enhance the love and the joy that exists within our education industry.
Awesome. I can't think of a better note on which to end, my friend. So this is the beginning of a great friendship and the first of hopefully many conversations to come. So with that, I'm going to sign off for now. It's great visiting with you, Brett.
Always, brother. Let's get some beaver nuggets next time I come.
You got them. Take care.